Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 9th of December, and you're listening to Reconstruction, the weekly podcast from the Construction Index. I'm David Taylor, editor of the Construction Index magazine, and I'm joined, as usual, by my colleague Phil Bishop, editor of our online news service. Hi there, Phil. How are you doing?
All good, as always. Morning, David. How are you?
I'm very well as well, yes. Yes, everything's fine here. And we've got, I don't know whether it's a big story to talk about, but there's something I know that you're keen to chew the fat over, Phil.
It is a big story.
Publication of a new report, I believe.
It's a very big story, or it should be, if all goes well, if it all comes to pass. It's weird, because it's, as you say, 9th of December, not much more than a couple of weeks to Christmas, and you kind of expect everything to be slowing down and the interest to start drying up and things to start. But you know, on the national arena in the big papers, we've got Brexit deadline, another deadline. I mean, the absolute Brexit ultimatum coming to a crunch. Vaccines have just started rolling out. Great news. Mm-hmm. So there's big stuff happening in the country and in the world in general. And in the construction industry, as you mentioned, we've had new, what it is effectively, government policy for construction industry set out in quite detailed terms. And this is called the construction playbook. It's kind of curiously, but that's what they're calling it.
Yeah, sorry, Phil. Can I just interject at this point? I know this is the sort of thing you like, and you'll have plenty to say about it. But I just wanted to say, before you get stuck in, I'm really disappointed with this. I thought a construction playbook sounded like a brilliant idea. It's exactly what the industry needs, I thought, especially after all we've been through this year. But I downloaded my copy, and I was so disappointed. It's not what I think of as a playbook. First of all, it's really long. I mean, it's over 80 pages. It's incredibly wordy. There's hardly any pictures, absolutely nothing to colour in.
I knew you were going there.
Crossword or quiz, and the jokes are crap.
No cardboard diggers to cut out and stick together.
No, exactly. I was so disappointed. So I'm glad it was free. I didn't have to pay for it. But I suppose we've got to discuss it, haven't we? After all, it's supposed to be important.
Well, unfortunately, it's not playbook in the traditional British sense of something that Floella Benjamin would read to you. It's sorry, younger listeners, ask your parents.
Floella Benjamin is the Chancellor of Exeter University, by the way. She's a serious person.
She's a member of the House of Lords, but she didn't used to be a serious person.
No, she didn't. No, anything but. Anyway, let's carry on.
No, I think they use the name playbook in the horrible American version. Is it just American football, or is it all American sports? I think it's particularly American football.
Oh, I've no idea.
A playbook in American football is a huge file. I've seen the movies where they plan their, you know, where the running line runner thingy person is going to run to, and where the quarterback is going to throw the ball forwards, bizarrely. Throws it forwards to someone. And
at least they're talking about playing.
Anyway.
Yes.
In this context, this is from the Cabinet Office, the construction playbooks, a government document, as you say, 80-something, 83 pages of it, free to download on government.gov.uk website, and well worth the read. And it basically tells, in the first instance, all central government departments and its arm's-length agencies like Highways England and so on, but ultimately when it wants all public sector, local authorities and so on, to adopt the policies set out in this document. And it's got the fingerprints of every construction industry vested interest all over it. So all the big construction industry organisations are well behind this and very happy and all supportive. And the only questions really that remain is how it comes to be implemented by various clients.
Or if it becomes implemented.
Well, no, I think it will.
You think it will? Okay.
I mean, it might be cherry-picked and bits might be, you know, quietly ditched. But there are... There's masses and masses to talk about in here, and it picks up on so many of the latest, not even that latest, but the 21st century aspects, buzz aspects of construction procurement, including framework contracts. Good, we like that. BIM and digital technologies, yep, tick, good. Off-site construction and prefabrication of particularly of components of buildings, tick, all there. Whole life costing, total cost of ownership. Things which are post-Carillion things, I suppose you could say, slightly. There's a lot in here about risk allocation and not dumping too much risk onto contractors and not expecting too much of them. And the whole drive behind it, the bottom line, is it's meant to essentially save the taxpayer money and enable construction companies also to share in that profit so that they can make some money, so they're not going to go bust left, right and centre. Mm. So it's meant to be, sorry to use the phrase, win-win, but it's meant to be win-win. I say there's an awful lot in there. Nothing hugely surprising. The only negative comment I've heard from someone is saying, why isn't the word diversity in there? And it's not, but I don't really see that's central to... I don't think taxpayers' money should be specifically spent on the construction company with the most diverse workforce. I mean, to be honest, I'd like public construction contracts to people who purely give the best value for money. But these days, value for money includes this whole concept of social value, which we've discussed before, which is an industry in itself. And diversity is often a factor, a measurement within social value. And that's diversity in its widest sense. So there's a lot in there. Have you had a chance to read it?
I haven't found any
pictures. But
I flipped through it looking at the pictures. But no, I haven't. There was nothing there which really caught my eye. I mean, I didn't notice the absence of diversity, but then why should I? It wasn't what I was looking for. But I don't know, a lot of the things are what you would expect in a report like this. And it's not the first time that they've been raised, and it's not the first time the government has declared its intention to push forward with things like the reduction of constructing the team and doing away with conflict within the industry, being more energy efficient and stuff like that. It's all been there before.
I don't know, but elements
in
elements
various guises.
But this puts it all together, I think, in a pretty solid way.
Why has it taken them so long then? I mean, because we were talking about these issues 20 years ago, and they've been it's waxed and waned. I haven't read it in detail, so forgive me. I might have missed quite a lot.
Well, there's,
but it seemed like a rehash of a lot of stuff that we've already heard before.
Well, there's no single element where you say, oh my God, we're not allowed to build out of wood. We're only allowed to use steel, and we can't use concrete. Mm-hmm. We've got to use X instead of Y. I mean, there's nothing shock horror in there.
No.
But it does turn the screw in an awful lot of directions. I mean, quote, they're now going to be an expectation for all government departments and what they call ALB, arm's length bodies, mm-hmm. highways agency, and things like housing, and a big part, things like that. So it's essentially it's government. For all government departments to set targets for the level of use of modern methods of construction, i.e. factories, factory-built stuff, in the delivery of projects and programmes, which is interesting and kind of wrong, because there are some jobs where off-site manufacturing, prefabrication is highly appropriate, and other jobs where it seems to me it's not. I mean, if you're building a dam, and okay, we don't build many dams here, but the lion's share of it is digging a hole, and then you're lining the hole. Now, okay, you might be lining it with concrete segments which can be fabricated 100 miles away and trucked in, or you can set up a fabrication yard on the side of the site. And does this sort of say, well, we must have a target of X for prefabrication?
It's not necessarily
a benefit, is it?
It bears no logic.
It bears no logic. No, how is England decide?
I mean, I think you're right in that, going back to what I said earlier, yes, we have heard all this in the past, all these measures have had their champions for years. I suppose the difference now is that this is basically a commitment. Government bodies are now committed to doing this. They're required. they're going to be required to hit these set these targets and hit them. And that's the difference. It's less of an aspirational statement and more of a practical framework, I suppose. So, I mean, if it, this is why I said, you know, if it gets implemented, because I wonder if the practicalities of actually rolling this out within the timescale that they foresee is actually doable. It depends so much on all these ALBs or ABLs, ALBs,
arm's length bodies, government agencies.
Yeah, arm's length, basically. Yeah. I suppose it'll take off and be really, really successful in some areas, and maybe it'll just sort of wither on the vine elsewhere. I don't know, but it is probably, if it does work, it's certainly high time that it did, because, as I say, we've been talking about it for many years.
There is one area which might cause concern. It does seem to heavily favour the established big players. If you're already in with government departments, you're probably well set. If you're looking to get in, this document might make it harder for you to get in. The whole idea of long-term contracts and framework contracts, it's great for the top of the industry to have its stability and know where the work's coming from, visibility, transparency and all of those things. It's great. But that can, it runs the risk of stifling innovation in terms of new people coming along with new ideas. And this is recognised and fair within the document. It does say this mustn't be at the expense of innovation and new players, new technology emerging. But it doesn't really explain how that inherent tension is going to be managed. And I think that's one to watch. I think we could be freezing out up-and-comers.
Yeah, so I think it's true to say that all the leading contractors and consultants, engineers, all the rest of it, are pretty well clued up with most of these issues, and they're already ready to roll them out, if you like. It depends on the client actually giving them the go-ahead. I think most of them, if you spoke to any of your sort of tier one contractors, they'd probably, they are saying this is great. They're all in favour of it because, as I say, they're up to speed with most of these issues anyway. But yes, if somebody comes along and tries to break the mould or do something slightly different, that could certainly cause them to close ranks, maybe. I don't know. But I certainly think it'd be difficult for somebody with any fresh ideas to get into this because there's a sort of an established orthodoxy here.
Well, if I was England, has a 10 or 20 year framework contract in place with half a dozen or three or four suppliers, that's what they want to do, these long-term contracts, which has an awful lot of benefits. But for anyone else to say, well, we've just got this whizzy new method, which is our IP and our proprietary technology, do you want to look at it, High Res England? And say, well, you'll have to wait till 2050 before we're going to talk to you, mate. Clearly that would be a bad thing.
Yes, that's true. So apart from the lack of diversity, which you pointed out earlier, have there been any other criticisms that you've noticed out in the industry of this? Does it fall short in any particular areas, or does it miss the point in others?
To be honest,
or is it universally acclaimed?
The usual suspects who have been swift to comment have been pretty overwhelmingly favourable. But as I say, what remains to be seen is it's how it's implemented and whether local authorities or organisations further away from the centre perhaps seek to cherry-pick it a bit. The playbook says that this will apply to all public works, projects and programmes on a comply or explain basis. In other words, you've got to do this unless you can explain why you're not doing it. And we might get some interesting explanations coming out in the future. But people say that, for example, I mean, the only area I can see, I can't see people really not favouring, you know, whole life costing and even framework contracts. It seems to be the thing, and sharing risk management. I can't see that anyone's really going to go away from that. But this idea of having, as I say, having a target for how much has to be made off-site seems strange to me. I mean,
it does seem rather rigid, sort of arbitrary.
Yeah, maybe that'll become clearer, and maybe I'm missing something. But by all means, use it where appropriate. But there are times where it may be not appropriate.
So this playbook, I mean, obviously, it's like a sort of a handbook. This is how you should go about your public sector procurement. Is there going to be a government minister overseeing this? Is there going to be a minister of
Well, there already is. Don't ask me who there is, but there's a chap in the Cabinet Office. I mean, not that long ago, I think Francis Maude came in to sort out public procurement.
Right.
The problem is that government public procurement has very recently had its name absolutely muddied by the rapid handing out of PPE and COVID-related jobs to mates and contracts to mates and people who drink in the right pubs and so on, allegedly. So a document like this can do nothing but good to set out and say, right, this is how it works. It's clean, it's fair. Industry's on board with this document. This is not a document that's being imposed upon industry. Mm-hmm. Industry's been involved in the development of it, many, many sides of the industry. So it is, hopefully it will address some of the negative perceptions of public procurement, which, I mean, to be honest, have never been very positive, have they, public procurement perceptions, but have been made worse in the wake of the COVID-related contracts. But to answer your question, there is a Minister for Public Procurement, but I don't know who it is.
Right, okay. And will each sort of government body and arm's length body, will it be up to them how they execute this to put in place their own procedures and ways of doing things, or will there be a sort of a standard procedure for all this?
There will be standard procedures. I think some of them already exist, and where they don't, more are coming out. I have skim read and read everything highlighted in this document, and I seem to remember, I haven't sort of learnt it completely in the past, whatever it's been, 16 hours since I picked it up, but I believe there is something in it that talks about from this there will be more templates, if you like, that relate to this. A lot of these templates exist, and there'll be more to be produced in the months ahead.
Okay.
You asked about industry reaction, and I'll just go through a few that we've posted on the constructionindex.co.uk website. Civil Engineering Contractors Association. The principles of the playbook have already started to become embedded in new projects and programmes, and we look forward to its rollout across the whole of government. There'll be a 3-year implementation programme to embed these processes and drive improvement within the public sector. While we recognise there's no one-size-fits-all approach, the establishment of the principles of the playbook will be strongly promoted by government, providing value for money for the taxpayer, blah, blah, blah. A couple of BAM chief executives, BAM Construct and BAM Nuttall chief executives, issued a joint thing, statement saying, the playbook promises a better future as long as its principles are adopted. One company and one client cannot do this on its own, and we encourage all clients, the contracting sector and the supply chain to get behind this. CBI, love it. Skanska Chief Greg Craig says it will help to deliver safer, faster and lower cost outcomes for customers. It's broadly being welcomed across the board. It's been described as a game changer, setting new foundations. So let's see. I mean, we've got enthusiastic about government policies before and nothing's particularly changed, but let's see.
So anything else grabbed your attention? I know there's been another publication, an even bigger one.
Oh, Lordy, talking of big documents, as we speak, I've yet to actually report anything on this. It's taken me a while to plough through 450-odd pages of the Committee on Climate Change, this organisation that advises government that's chaired by John Gummer, if you remember him, Environment Secretary from the 1990s and Agriculture Secretary from the, maybe even the 80s, he's Agriculture Secretary, but he's still around chairing this organisation, the Committee on Climate Change. And they've produced, essentially, it's a 6th annual report, they call it their budget, carbon budget, setting out a plan of action, a pathway, a route map, and the word, terms.
I'm surprised they don't call it a playbook, actually.
But... Oh, no, this is serious stuff. This is the planet we're saving. This is not no play here. No, it's a route map.
Okay.
So there's a lot in it as to how are we going, the UK is going to be net zero by whenever it's going to be net zero carbon. And this, that, and the other.
Sometime next week, I think, isn't it?
It's getting nearer and nearer.
As it would.
It's all getting cranked down. Well, it's getting not because we're getting nearer the target. The target's also being brought nearer to us.
Yeah, they keep bringing it forward.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There. The initial things that my eye has been drawn to are things about making homes more energy efficient, basically, and bringing down bills and less carbon intensive, which is all about having hydrogen boilers or ground source, air source, heat pumps and this sort of stuff. And there's been a lot of talk about already the targets for new house building. Now, all the recommendations of the Committee on Climate Change are just recommendations to government. The government will doubtless pick up some of them and say, yeah, we're great, we're green, we're doing this, and quietly dump other things. But amongst the recommendations, again, some of these are new or newish or tightened and others are familiar. All new buildings are to be zero carbon by 2025 at the latest.
2025?
In 5 years' time. But what I'm not in the market for a new house. I own a moderately old house. I suspect not as old as yours. I think the oldest bits of my house are probably date back to the 1920s or something. It's drafty. Front door doesn't fit properly. My fuel bills are extortionate, and I'm aware that I need to do something about it. And this carbon budget document is basically saying, come 2028, if my house is not EPC C rated, and I couldn't even tell you what my
That's
current
energy
rating
performance
is.
Certificate, isn't it?
That's it.
Yeah.
And I don't even know what my current rating is, but I wouldn't be surprised if I was worse than that. But if I'm not energy performance certificate C rated by 2028, I'm not allowed to sell it.
No. You can actually find out what your... I did this exercise, found out what my energy certificate, energy performance certificate is for my house. There's a very good little part of the government website which breaks it all down for you. It's very, very good. Energy performance certificates, they go from A, which is sort of like your sort of super efficient, energy efficient house. Doesn't require any energy at all to run. It just sort of, you know... Anyway, it goes from that to G. And, of course, C is less than halfway down. And so I think that's quite a big ask, actually, to expect in 8 years' time every house to be C-rated, have a C-rated EPC in order to be sold legally. I did check out my current EPC, and it's G.
Ooh.
It could not be... My house could not be, energy inefficient. I should point out, I don't know when this certificate was awarded, but I suspect it was before I bought the place, because it's a bit scary. It's a bit big brothery, actually, because they know all about your house. For example...
Do they know how often you clean it, though, David?
No, luckily it doesn't actually say anything about that at all, but I don't think that affects the energy performance. Although a good coating of dust on most surfaces would probably improve things. But no, it describes my walls as granite or whin. And I looked up whin, W-H-I-N.
W-H-I-N? I've not heard that.
Yeah, it's gorse. Oh. It's gorse. I mean, I don't know what... there is something called wind stone, so I don't know what that is. But yeah, they think that my walls are made out of either stones and gorse with no insulation. It's got a pitched roof with 250 millimetres of loft insulation, which is good, apparently. The windows are all single glazed, very poor. Main heating, room heaters, electric... Very poor. Well, they're not. No thermostatic control of room temperature, which is poor. Secondary system, hot water is a secondary system, no cylinder. Anyway, this is all rather out of date, except the windows are all single glazed. And like yours, it leaks like a sieve.
Although what the website probably doesn't know, I don't know what you've got in your house, but our biggest, draftiest windows in our living room, we spent... a little bit of money on thermally insulated blinds, which do a great job of keeping the room warm overnight when the heating's off. So we may fail on the EPC front, but we're keeping our, helping to keep our bills down another way by getting thick thermally insulated blinds. Now that can help, but that's not,
yeah,
that doesn't seem to enter the equation at all in this thinking, does it?
No, it doesn't. I mean, since this certificate was issued, we've had new concrete floor put in downstairs with underfloor heating. We've got a new low energy gas boiler. We've got thick blinds, you know, and stuff like that.
Still a gas boiler. That'll have to go eventually.
Still a gas. Yeah. By 2035, I think they don't want any gas boilers.
I think there's an assumption that if they stop fitting new ones, I don't think they're ever going to come. I don't think the boiler police are ever going to knock on your door and say that's got to go.
And rip the boiler out.
I think it's when it naturally expires, you won't be able to replace it with a gas boiler.
That's fair enough. Mind you, I did have a chap round to service my boiler a few weeks ago. He looked at it and he said, how old is this? And I said, well, we've been here 8 years and we had it put in from new. He said, 8 years? Ooh. That's, you know, they've only got a life of about 7 or 8 years, which is rubbish.
They do say that, don't they? Aware. Yeah.
It was a typical case of sucking the teeth and saying, oh, I don't know who put that in, mate.
Do you have your boiler serviced every year like you're supposed to?
No.
No, me neither, I'm afraid. I'm sure that's a fair bit. It's like the mattress companies say you have to have a new mattress every 25 minutes.
I don't even turn my mattress that often, but anyway. No, so I think that this document, I know that these are recommendations to the government. It isn't actually government policy, is it?
No, it's not. But the upshot, I mean, if homeowners like you and I will look at this and go, oh, Lordy, we've got to do something now. Construction industry, who we're supposed to be talking to here, David, not just each other, have every reason to rub their hands in glee and going, yippee,
absolutely.
Work coming down the road rapidly. It sounds like if you turn to page 120 of the carbon budget from the Committee on Climate Change, it gives some costs that they've done. They reckon by 2050, so the next 30 years, total investment on all buildings to make them zero carbon or whatever they're supposed to be, £360 billion over 30 years, of which £250 billion is for upgrading homes and £110 billion in public and commercial buildings. And they're saying by 2050, but of course they're also saying, well, all the stuff's got to be done by 2028. So essentially, there's going to be billions and billions of pounds that has to be spent on homes up and down the country, retrofitting them, making them less leaky and drafty. My fear is, of course, and we've discussed this, you and I, privately, that everyone's going to end up with those awful plastic double glazing, weird stone cladding on the outside, or all sorts of.
I know.
Old, nice old houses could be at risk of being ruined. So hopefully, the heritage lobby get heavily involved in this and make sure everyone does work on their homes sympathetically, because I think the built environment is as important as the natural environment, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, and I think unfortunately, the majority of people, and I'm sure there'll be hordes of people out there telling me that I'm wrong, don't really care about old buildings very much, and the unstoppable march of the.
So he's saying
PVC
you don't care.
Window brigade.
He's saying you don't care.
No, I do. The majority of homeowners in the UK probably don't care that much about old buildings, and you can't blame somebody for wanting to live in a warm house. Although I find modern houses, my parents' house was unbearable. It was like walking into a sauna. You could barely breathe.
Oh, but that's old people. My granny's house was like that 50 years ago.
Yeah, I suppose that is true. I don't know, but Your house is in a conservation area, so you were saying you won't be required to replace your timber windows with plastic ones. I'm on the edge of a conservation
area. You won't be able
to. won't be able to what?
Well, you said I won't be required to replace wooden windows with plastic.
No.
I won't be allowed to. I have to get more expensive wooden double glazing.
Oh, that's right, yes.
Which I am. Of course, I have it in mind to be honest.
Hmm. It's a big investment, though, and I walk around my village, most of which is in the conservation area, and you can count the number of houses with the original timber casements or sash windows on the fingers of one hand, basically. Every house has had them ripped out and horrible plastic windows put in. And it really does impact very badly on the overall appearance of a building. It ruins a building, in my opinion. But of course, if you're cold and you want to be warm and you don't want to have to spend a lot of money on gas or electricity and you want to save the planet, can't argue against it, really.
But not only that, now we've all got Netflix and Xboxes and things, no one's got time to actually maintain and repaint their windows and look after them like they need to. So everything falls apart. And so they want stuff. People seem to want stuff they can throw away and just put something plastic in its place so they can get back to their Netflix.
You're absolutely right. And since you've got me on this particular hobby horse, I always bridle when I hear people talking about plastic windows which are maintenance-free. I have an architect friend who specialises in old buildings, and he said they're not maintenance-free, they're maintenance-resistant. With an old Victorian sash window, you can strip them, you can paint them, you can splice in new bits when a bit of rot appears. You can keep those windows going
forever.
For decades.
Forever.
I don't suppose any of the plastic windows in houses across the country now will still be there in 100 years' time. Because once they've gone, they've gone. You can't maintain them. So they're not maintenance free. So there we are. Rant over.
Right, good. I think we've only scratched the surface of the carbon budget pathway
we
thing.
We have.
There's masses in there.
And exposed our prejudices in the process, yeah.
We're old. Put us on the scrap heap, though. That's the only answer. What else? What else caught your eye?
Well, Rudy, an old acquaintance of mine, a chap well-known in the construction industry, Rudy Klein, who is the chief executive of the SEC Specialist Engineering Council, long-standing champion of subcontractors and specialist contractors across the UK, has announced that he's retiring. I don't think he's retiring completely, going off to his small holding in Shropshire or wherever he lives. But Rudy is a well-known character in the industry. He's Professor Rudy Klein. He's also a barrister and a tireless campaigner for the underdog in many ways, because of course specialist contractors, subcontractors, they're a bit down the pecking order. They're the ones who, well, by definition, when there's some subby bashing going on, they're the ones that get bashed. And Rudy has been for many years arguing for a change in the procurement process. We were talking about this obviously earlier in the conversation, and how procurement has often been traditionally been very adversarial in construction, and that...
Well, no one wants to spend more money than they have to, do they, of course?
No. And things like cash retentions and all sorts of things, and actually putting pressure on suppliers when a main... This is the sort of thing that used to happen. The main contractor would get into trouble, it wanted to save some money, didn't want to pay its bills. It would keep its supply chain hanging on until hopefully one or two of them fell off their perch and they didn't have to pay them. And that's the sort of thing that Rudy has always been campaigning against with things like project bank accounts. He's a huge advocate of project bank accounts, which is an idea, again, going back many, many years, but finally, it seems, sort of beginning to gain traction. So I was rather sorry to see news that Rudy was retiring. He's a great talker, a good writer as well. When I was editing the law report in Construction News many years ago, Rudy was one of six or seven regular contributors, and I hardly ever had to touch his copy. It was always extremely well written. It was to the point, very persuasive. He was a very eloquent chap. Well, he's a barrister, so you'd expect that. Yeah, he'll be missed, but I think he's not completely retiring. You posted a story about him on the website today, which I haven't read.
He's still going to be in private legal practice. Advice and so on. But he's just stepping down the role of chief executive of the Specialist Engineering Contractors Group. So he'll have no formal industry wide title. He'll just be that there Rudy Klein.
Right. Yeah.
But I hadn't realised that not only was he at least one of, if not the architect of the 1996 Construction Act. He also drafted the Irish Construction Contracts Act in 2013.
No, I didn't know that.
Internationally active.
Well, he's made a huge contribution to the industry, I think. I haven't spoken to him for months, if possibly years, actually. It's a long time since I spoke to Rudy, but I think we'll get in touch with him. I'm going to get in touch with him and wish him all the best. Maybe we can even persuade him to come on and join us in a discussion on the podcast.
That would be excellent. Plenty for him to talk about, I'm sure. That always, it's never off the agenda, the whole issue of payment practices. Maybe he'll have a chance to have digested the playbook implications by then and come on with his thoughts about that.
Yeah, we'll get him to tell us what that's all about. Okay, yeah, I'll get in touch with him. So if you're listening, Rudy, expect a phone call.
Great stuff. I think that's all we've got time for this week, David. We've been going on for plenty long enough. Okay. Thank you, everyone, for listening to Reconstruction again. And it's getting close to Christmas. Have you started doing any shopping yet, David?
Yes, I've bought one present so far. And I've bought a Christmas tree.
You got a tree?
I've been up in the loft. Yeah, we've got a tree. Why? Why are you surprised? Everybody has a tree, don't they?
I didn't think. I thought you were more of a kind of Christmas Eve soon enough for a tree kind of a person.
I used to be. And then I would get into the Christmas spirit on Christmas Eve. 24 hours later, it was all over. And I thought, I'm missing something. And it was actually my youngest daughter, whose birthday is on the 24th of November, started to insist several years ago that Christmas actually started after her birthday. She wanted it to be one continuous revelry right through to the new year. And I actually began to see the logic behind this. So now we've compromised and we don't get the Christmas tree after her birthday. We get it after mine, which was at the weekend.
Oh, happy birthday, and, David. I'm sorry. I had no idea.
No. Well, I try not to take any notice of it either these days. So, yeah, we went out and got the tree. Yeah, and that's really it. So we're in full Christmas mode now, really.
Excellent. Well, we've not got our tree yet, but we've got the decorations out of the loft and we're all ready to go get a tree as soon as it stops raining, frankly.
All right then, Phil.
All right, see you next week, David. Good to talk to you. Bye.
All right then. Bye, folks.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.